If you're here and your desk chair is not unstacked, you need to go and do that, please.
It's springtime, and a school day has just begun in this second grade classroom at Ingalls Elementary. As kids settle into their seats, their teacher, Aubrey Payne, makes an announcement.
Also, Victoria T. moved away. I know. Yeah. Yeah, she did. So now we have one Vicky.
Her class just lost a student, or actually, make that another student. Over the course of the year, 5 kids left Miss Payne's class and 13 new ones arrived in their place.
So until we get another student, that is our new safe seat until we get a new student.
This scenario is not unique, either in the Hickman Mills district or others. Kids leaving classrooms partway through the year, others showing up just as unexpectedly. There's a term for this in education circles. It's called churn. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and today we're going to unpack some reporting we've been doing throughout the school year. Reporter Barb Shelley's been hanging out with the kids and teachers at Ingalls Elementary, where she's gotten to know the situation in all its complexity. Hey, Barb.
Hey, Gina. Thanks for having me here.
Thanks for being here, and thanks for all this reporting. That morning, when it was announced that there would be one less Vicky in Ms. Payne's class, you could hear one of the kids sounding surprised and really kind of distraught. And we're going to be getting into big issues like poverty and housing instability, even homelessness. But that little moment really got to me because these are just kids, and it's a reminder that they're losing friends without warning, without a chance to say goodbye.
Yeah, these kids that are in the classroom and have been there since the beginning, or even if they haven't, they see a lot of change and a lot of coming and going. And I think one of the hardest things for the teachers and the children is that they don't get to say goodbye. In the case of that little girl, Victoria T, they called her that to distinguish her from the other Vicky in the class. She was there on a Friday, and she asked her teacher for her homework folder to bring back on Monday. And then on Monday, she never showed up, and they never heard anything. The school, they get on it really fast and start calling, and they reached somebody who said the family had moved to another district over the weekend.
Wow. So it sounds like that is not totally atypical.
Oh, no. It's what happens. You know, of those 5 children you talked about that left Aubrey Payne's second grade class, only 2 of them, you know, gave her advance notice that they were leaving. And I should say that those numbers you gave, 5 children left and 13 came in some cases they were the same students. So it's actually a double count. Well, I know one little girl came in, I think, in October, and by Christmas she was gone. And, you know, the teacher never found out where she had went or anything. And there were a couple kids that both came in and left within a short period.
So why do kids come and go? Just quickly lay out some of the main causes.
Well, you know, in what I observed, it's just a variety of things. A lot of it does have to do with the transient housing situation down there, and the fact that we're dealing with an acutely low-income population that moves around a lot. There's a lot of homelessness, a lot of doubling up, a lot of transients.
Doubling up.
Mm-hmm.
Explain.
Well, doubling up, you know, the houses down there, a lot of them are rather large, 4 or 5 bedrooms. And so, you know, if somebody in the family gets evicted or something, they might come and move in with somebody else, a friend or another relative or somebody.
So then you'd have to go where that friend or relative lives, regardless mm-hmm. of where your kid goes to school.
Yeah, and those aren't real permanent situations. Sometimes they don't work out, and so then someone moves again. I also saw, you know, some family situation where children are kind of traded around among different relatives.
Why?
I saw a couple situations where parents were incarcerated. I saw, you know, just some situations where I wrote about an example where a little boy was staying with a grandparent down there in Hickman Mills, and his mom lived up in Kansas City, and she had custody of him, and she wanted him to come live with her. you know, pretty close to the end of the school year. So off he went. Again, no one notified the school. They had to track this down. And then the mom never really enrolled him in a Kansas City public school. He actually ended up coming back in the classroom one day, in the second grade classroom. And they, you know, they said, well, can he just finish here? And of course, he isn't a resident of the Hickman Mills School District anymore. So the answer is no. And that is a really sad situation. I'm sure he missed 3 or 4 weeks of school.
We'll dive deeper into all of these issues in a little while. But tell me, I mean, you've got lots of numbers in your reporting and the stories people may have heard on Morning Edition. But how common is this in Hickman Mills?
It's incredibly common. In Ingalls Elementary, their mobility rate this year is 70%. And what that means is the number of students coming in and coming out is 70% of the official September enrollment. And I got numbers for the Hickman Mills School District as a whole, and it is 80%. You know, that means that people are just moving in and out of classrooms all the time.
Remind us of the boundaries of the district and some of its recent history that we may need to understand what we're talking about.
Well, Hickman Mills School District is in South Kansas City and, you know, it encompasses Bannister Mall and the area there, bumps up against Grandview. You know, it was as recently as the 1980s, a working class, stable community. And then a lot of things have happened with housing, jobs. And right now it's, you know, very much a rental, transient community.
What are some of the main challenges that arise for teachers when they're constantly getting new students who haven't been there for previous lessons, et cetera?
It is really profound. You know, I think Aubrey Payne will talk about, you know, she has to...
The teacher who spent a lot of time with.
Thank you. Yeah, I did. And, you know, she talked about how she has to assess where these students are as far as their reading, their math skills. And if they're not where the class is, she has to find time with them to get them called up. I also saw, you know, Ingalls and Hickman Mills School District, like many school districts, they're moving to iPads, learning on iPads, and they have to because the Missouri MAP test is done on computers. The kids need to be fluent on these things. But when a new student comes in, well, they have to be set up on an iPad, and then there's passwords and usernames for different programs, and oh, that can just take a ton of time every time a new student moves in.
What about the parents' perspective? Barb, one of the parents you met was Sharonda Hooker Dennis. Her son's name is Hassan, and their story involves a lot of moves.
Hassan was at University Academy, and then I had to move, and he ended up going to Santa Fe Elementary School, which is in the Hickman Mills School District. Then I moved back to Kansas City, Missouri, and he was in Leah Tolbert's, and now we're back in South Kansas City again.
This is a mom who understands what's at stake for her son because her childhood was also characterized by frequent moves. She says she went to 4 different high schools.
I had reading problems when I was in school. I really wasn't good at math. I kept an F in math because everybody teaches different.
It's clear from your reporting that Sharonda doesn't want to put her son through this. Explain what's going on for this family and others.
Right. And Sharonda, I didn't meet her at Ingalls. I actually met her in the library, in the Plaza Library. We were in the children's area over winter break. I was there with my little granddaughter, and she was there with her children, and we just got to talking. And she really feels bad that she has, you know, put her son through this transience. She's had some problems. We've talked about eviction on the show, and she's had some problems with that, and her housing situation hasn't been stable. And yet she knows what she wants for her son, and she feels that he is behind because of these moves and, you know, the fact that she hasn't been able to get him into a classroom where he can get some individual attention and things like that. And she's still trying to figure it out. In fact, she tells me she may move again over the summer, although that's not clear whether that'll work out or not.
The superintendent of the district is with us now, or actually the outgoing superintendent of the district, Dennis Carpenter. Good morning.
Good morning.
What do you hear in Hassan and Sharonda's story? I think there must be pieces of this that people on the outside just wouldn't understand.
It's a heartbreaking story, and it's one that is so frequently misunderstood. It's viewed as some internal deficit all too quickly as it relates to the child. But in all actuality, these are societal factors that the child and the family are attempting to deal with. So when we attempt to talk about a child that's mobile, we have to move from that place of blame and really talk about the financial insecurities and the home instabilities that cause families and children to be mobile. I think a U.S. Department of Accountability study was done in 2010, and it basically talked about 39% of the students who are highly mobile in the United States come from families who do not have home ownership.
You know, can I just jump in and say, do I understand you right that it sounds like you're saying there's an impulse to say, whose fault is this?
Absolutely.
And that's not helpful?
Well, that's the easy thing to do. It's always easy to point the finger and find someone to blame, because when we do that, some of the research says that gives politicians and it gives leaders this feeling of doing something when I blame someone. But it's just too deep to quickly try and cast blame.
Well, we're going to get back to Dennis Carpenter, but we've got a parent on the line, and I want to talk to her. But I also want to know if you or your kids have had to pack up and leave schools partway through the year. Have you had to do that more than once? Help us understand it from your perspective. 816-235-2888 is the number to call. And if you have ideas about solutions, we'd really love to hear those, too. Let's talk to Callie Ross. Callie, good morning.
Good morning.
Tell me your story. Tell me about yourself and your kids.
Okay, so I have two kids. One's 9 and one's 2. The one that is 9 has switched. I think he went to a different school every year. And on a couple of occasions, he's gone to more than one school in 1 year. And so we've been very mobile. We've had different issues. I think kind of what he was saying, not having home ownership. Can keep you moving. At one point, we lived in a hotel. At one point, we lived in a shelter. We now rent a rental property that unfortunately changed ownership 3 times while living there and has now been sold. So now we will be moving again.
So that's maybe the kind of thing that we need to take into account when people are trying to understand why you'd move is that sometimes when you're renting, it's not your choice how long you get to stay somewhere.
No, we've only been there 6 months, and it's basically changed ownership 3 times in 6 months and has been sold to a new owner that doesn't wish to continue renting it. So now he may have to change schools. Likely he will have to change schools again for the next year. Because I have an eviction, it will be very difficult for me to find housing in this area any area. So I will have to take whatever I can find.
I know that any individual family's financial situation is both sensitive and complicated, but can you help us understand kind of what's underneath the struggles that you're dealing with here?
Well, even when I had money and was working, I could not find anybody that would rent to me because I had an eviction from a few years ago. That kind of rooted the problem, and you know, you work where you live, and trying to put all it together when you only have little pieces of it is difficult. Now that I have a job, working full-time, I don't know how to say it's difficult. You know, I don't have a car. I ride the bus. So where I can live has a lot to do with that.
Yeah, you have to have all those pieces where the kids are at school, where you work, where you live, kind of operating together.
Yeah, it's hard to get all those pieces lined up, especially when you're kind of taking what you have and trying to make it work, and everything has to work in coordinates.
So how do your kids deal with the changes in school? Can you paint the picture for us of what it's like for them?
Well, it's difficult. Over the school year, being in a new area, it's been very difficult for my older son. He's had a hard time making friends in the neighborhood. He finds himself stuck in the house a lot. eventually he did make a friend next door that happened to be in his class, which was just brightened up his face. And that's disappointing that was only one person. I wish that could be his whole class or his whole neighborhood. But if you're not in one place very long, he has found himself, his behavior has kind of went different ways because he's more concerned about making friends and fitting in than learning, and maybe his attitude isn't number one all the time. I've noticed that. Another thing I've noticed is trying to get adjusted and stay where you are, you don't have a lot of time to look into extracurricular activities. So maybe things that are going on in the school for the kids or in the community get put on a back burner because you're trying to struggle to keep the child there. And I feel like he's missed opportunities with the school this year.
Is there something that you wish schools would do or could do to make this easier on him or on you?
I think just you guys airing this topic alone, I read the article, and it's amazing that this needs to be brought up. I know many people like myself that go through this, and nobody understands unless you've been there. It's not one thing you can do to fix it. It's information. It's even when we lived in the shelter, they want to help you. And the way that they helped me the most was letting me know that there are resources out there to connect to other families. When you connect with other people, it starts to help you solve some of your problems and help other people at the same time. And most people won't mind helping. They want to help. They want to see, you know, your household, the community, the schools better. So I think that the information that you guys are providing should be more somehow public. If the schools could offer counseling, even a counseling for people like me and my family, just to help them understand the resources that are around, I think it would make a great difference.
Kaylee, thank you so much for talking to us.
No problem.
And, I want to get some response to a lot of the things that Kaylee just told us about her situation and her family's situation. First of all, this issue of making friends, the idea that this kid is already going through so much and then has to struggle to make a new friend, one new friend. Superintendent Carpenter, is there something that schools can do to help these kids socially that maybe hasn't been done enough?
Yes, thank you. And first, I just want to honor Kaylee's voice and just appreciate her for sharing her truth for myself and the viewers. I would tell you that we expend in a highly mobile school district. I appreciate Barb's work in the 80% figure that she shared with you all earlier. But we've employed family school liaisons in each school. And oftentimes the primary focus of their work is dealing with student mobility and student absenteeism. And a part of that is connecting students with resources and the like, and connecting families with resources and the like to assist with the problem. I would tell you that I heard something in her voice about counseling for students who are in that category, and that's super important. And the reason that's important is students who move and economic drivers are causing those moves, put another way, poverty. The research also tells us that they're impacted by significant amounts of trauma. And when we add resources, i.e. a family school liaison in every building, so you talk about 14 school sites, give or take, and you talk about salary and benefits somewhere north of $50,000, you start to see the financial impact to the district. And when you talk about additional counseling supports, by the time you look at salary and benefits, you're somewhere north of $70,000 per person. So that becomes a burden on the school district. And that's why I always talk about this issue as it relates to funding and resources of equity versus equality. And that matters.
So how does the number of students in a classroom affect funding? Is there a relationship there?
Well, the relationship is average daily attendance. And when those students are not in the classroom, on those count days and the like, and looking at those averages when your attendance is low, that has a disparate impact on the district's funding.
So it sounds like the problem that students are coming and going from the classrooms makes the solution financially really challenging.
More challenging, absolutely. And if you're expending dollars on resources that are indirectly related to curriculum and instruction, but you're held to the same standard around student achievement as a district that does not have to invest in that way because of the difference in economics from one community to another, then the system is inherently flawed. And that's something that I don't like missing an opportunity to share with our greater community.
What about this question of extracurriculars? Is that... I can imagine someone viewing that in the context of this discussion as like a sort of maybe less important consideration. But what is the importance of extracurriculars?
Very important. And I'm glad that you raised that point from her conversation. We all know that when a child connects to something in the school space, whether it be co-curricular or extracurricular, beyond simply going to class and going home, their chances of being successful academically goes up exponentially. So when a child is so mobile, and I heard the mother pretty much say, I'm so concerned about the struggle of keeping him in the place, I just don't have time to worry about connecting him to an extracurricular, then mom doesn't want this, district doesn't want this, but we know that that lessens the likelihood of that child being successful academically. And that's a real issue in communities like ours.
When KCUR's Central Standard returns, we want to hear your story. If you've been a part of what we're calling churn as a parent or student, did your kids have to pack up and leave school partway through the year? Help us understand it from your perspective. 816-235-2888 is the number to call. And if you have ideas about solutions, please share those too. I'm Gina Kaufman, back in a minute. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and today we're talking about school mobility. In other words, districts where classrooms are dealing with a constant game of musical chairs, kids leaving and enrolling seemingly randomly throughout the year, so that the roll call looks totally different at the end of the year than it did when the school year started. You can call 816-235-2888 to join the conversation. We have numbers, we have statistics, we have big ideas. But are we missing something that you've experienced firsthand? That's when we want you to call that number, 816-235-2888. KCUR has been working with freelance reporter Barb Shelley on a year-long project looking into school mobility in the Hickman Mills District. Hi again, Barb.
Hi again.
And outgoing superintendent of Hickman Mills is here too, Dennis Carpenter. Welcome back.
Thanks a lot.
How long were you at Hickman Mills?
Just over 4 years, about 4 years and 3 months.
How did you see the situation evolve in that time, or did it?
I don't know that I anticipated the situation when I got there. I will tell you that when I came, the district was still dealing with the economic crisis, so it was there. I think as my...
Which economic crisis?
Well, I think more about 2008, and even when I arrived in 2013, the district was still feeling the impact from the Great Recession. And when I arrived, I didn't anticipate the issue of student mobility. It wasn't until I was in the district for a year and we started looking at the data and looking at the numbers. And finally, I said, whoa, this is a big deal. And this is one of those issues that's hampering our ability to be successful. And just around that time, the city started looking at the issue and it commissioned a research study, I believe, with Leanne Taylor Knight. And I was able to connect with her and really tease out those figures for Hickman Mills versus looking at the region as a whole. And those numbers were alarming when you looked at schools that simply had student mobility north of 70% in a given school year.
So talk to me a little bit more about what you mean by, you know, you said that the school district was really suffering from the impact of that recession. Can you help me picture what it was that you saw that told you that?
Just lack of engagement and just economic disparity. You could look around the community and see businesses that were still boarded up and not in service, and you still see some of that little change now with the emergence of Cerner, but just so much despair in the community. And you saw that in the students, and you saw that in the district and its employees kind of not knowing where to go next. So we really had to, in some ways, try and breathe life back into both the district and the community over time.
What I found in my reporting is that Hickman Mills, Ruskin area really got slammed by the foreclosure crisis in 2008 and 2009. They had been selling houses down there, you know, at mortgages with variable interest rates, sometimes no down payment. And then, you know, when they called in and raised the interest rates, people were unable to sell the homes, and they abandoned homes in that area in droves.
What industries, what kinds of jobs do parents in this district for the most part work? I mean, what are some of the main sources of income, and what are some of the main industries that they might be relying on?
Great question. I think I see a lot of our parents in the service industry, number one. And I also see lots of parents taking on multiple jobs, trying to combine those incomes into a living wage. So when we have this conversation about the need to pay families or employees a living wage, that's real for parents in poverty. And then there's this misnomer, oh, they're lazy, they need to pull themselves up by the proverbial bootstraps. But when you really dig in, you find out that parents are piecing together two and three jobs, and they're still not getting into a space where paying the mortgage or paying the rent is not a major issue.
Let's talk to a caller at 816-235-2888. Vince is joining us from Waldo. Hi, Vince.
Hey, how you doing? Just a personal issue in that I've worked with a lot of kids at youth and have faced many of these problems. One of the things I think you're going to have to do, school districts, I know it's hard, but they're going to have to kind of be non-traditional. And in that, they may offer something as simple as having washing machines at their schools so that kids or parents can have access to washing their clothes. Simple things like that that we take for granted. We think, okay, you got a few change, you could go wash your clothes. But if you don't, and like you just said, if they're piecing together two and three jobs, they're working into the midnight hours. They're tired. Maybe the clothes didn't get washed. And also, like, transportation. One school district I saw, and this was out of town, they had a kind of a bus that the school had access to. And basically it was about picking up parents and dropping them off at different jobs. Very non-traditional way of doing it, but those simple things that we take for granted. Because what happens when you're poor, you get a repo on your car. It's hard to get a car. And then once you get a car, it's probably not up to par. If it breaks down, you're behind the eight ball again. I'm glad the lady said what she said about the eviction, because it's the same way. And so that's why you have people move in with each other, because their credit is not up to par.
Yeah, like once you have an eviction, it's hard to rent, period. So then your options are limited.
Eviction, repos, and everything else. So if you don't have a place to live and you don't have transportation, how are you going to survive, especially a city like this, because we don't have a great public transportation system because we're so spread out. And downtown is not an option for someone who does not have any money. Unfortunately, downtown has, you know, their transportation is a lot better downtown, but getting jobs and everything else, you're talking about skills, you're talking about, of course, racism along with that, because the person that you had on before, the lady, the girl, basically she did what her mom did, and now her son is going to probably repeat what she did, not by because, you know, it was intentional, it was just like, this is what we had to do to survive, and unfortunately, you're trying to break it. But when those resources, those small resources that probably if people who had those resources could just pull together and says, hey, we can buy two washing machines. We can buy two dryers. We'll put them in the school. Boom. Open the school up maybe for non-traditional hours, you know, in the evening sometime or very early in the morning, just for those simple things, because, you know, they are become the kids are very conscious about other kids have this, they have that. And so then kids don't want to go to school. And then not only that, for the kids, they're very anxious. Depression comes up on them at young ages, and then they don't have the tools to deal with them because they're young.
You know,
so
Vince, you have brought up so much, and I'm really glad you did. There's one thing you brought up that I really want to follow up with you on and with our guests in the studio. You mentioned racism, and Could you spell out a little more clearly how you see race playing into this?
Okay, well, I'm a personal example of that. Institutionalized racism. I'm hitting my 50s now, so I'm dating myself. But when you have institutionalized racism, what you have is we don't know what to do with black kids. That's what overwhelmed Hickman Mills system. I mean, Hickman Mills, you know, you take it back into the early 80s, it was a totally white school district. But then it got overwhelmed with black kids, and you had folks who did not know what to do with black kids. So a lot of times they would pass them. They were not able to read. So you're basically producing illiterates into society, and then what happens from that, they can't get good jobs. So they get a lot of service industry jobs. So when you have a school district, and I know that it's trying to change now, but my personal example is I went to Southwest High School, and for most of it, and once again, it was a school that was over, you know, it was overwhelmed with black kids. They sent most of the black kids to technical centers. Nothing wrong with that if that's what that kid wants to do. But when you have a technical center that has 95% black kids because you don't want to take a chance to say, hey, why don't we send this kid to a college fair or at least expose them to information about college? No, just send all those black kids down to the technical center. Now, the reason why they did that, because they would have to deal with them less during the day. So they looked on them as being discipline problems. And all it is that it's a different way. I've taught and I've worked with black. It's a different way of teaching them. It can be taught. It can be learned. But when you have, here's what most people don't understand, adults. Kids know when you don't like them. They know that. Whether you say it or not, or you're trying to fake it, kids know that. And I know that for a fact. And the reason I know that, because I'll pull kids. That's how you get to find out about the kids. You pull them from their peer group and you talk to them one-on-one. They'll tell you everything they need to know. I didn't eat last night. My mom didn't come home last night. I've been at home for the last 2 days and I haven't ate. So once again, that's kind of the institutionalized racism in that, you know, you have kids and adults who were not educated. And I guess to unpack it even more, if we go all the way back to slavery, I don't want to go too deep, but slavery was very intentional. Very intentional in all its efforts. Don't teach blacks how to read, okay? Parents who don't know how to read can't teach their kids how to read. Those kids don't learn how to read. So everybody gets behind the eight ball generation after generation. And so when you have those things that have been put in place, and it's not overt now, it's more institutionalized. And, you know, you take inner city schools, their reading levels, and once again, Kansas City School District was unaccredited, and you're dealing with a whole lot of black kids who come from parents, who come from parents, who come from parents of generations of being discriminated against, not being offered, you know, a fair education. And so with that, you can't argue that you're dealing with problems and issues that were done intentionally,
right,
you know, 150 years ago. So that's why it was effective.
Thank you so much, Vince. So much to address there, but I'd also like your answer to that question, Dennis Carpenter. I mean, how does race matter? Does race matter?
We've agreed as a school district, and maybe in a few isolated cases, we've agreed to disagree. But by and large, we've agreed that race does matter in the schooling process. And our board has adopted a policy that basically gives the administration and the leadership of the district the authority to eliminate or interrupt those systemic practices that over time have led to the predictably lower performance of kids of color. And that's in our board adopted policy. I don't believe, and I'll never believe, that any educator went to school, got a degree, undertook student teaching and everything that comes with that to arrive in a classroom and marginalize any child from a marginalized group. But I also know that there are kids marginalized in the school setting. So with that being said, we've kind of examined how does race matter in school? And we've come up with three things with the help of an outside facilitator. We realize that race matters in terms of color, culture, and consciousness. So if you look at our teachers, just to give you a quick frame of reference, about 80% of our teachers are white and 90% of our kids are kids of color. So just there, we know that color is different. And when color is different, a lot of the time we know that culture is different. So just those differences alone may tend to create some friction in the learning environment just simply because of the disconnect. So when we talk about it, we've honored the fact that we start off by teaching our culture first and our content second. So we have to start bridging cultures, and that's something we're trying to do as a district.
How does that play into this mobility issue we've been talking about?
Wow, I think it puts us into a place where we honor the struggle of families, not unlike some of those we've heard about today. And we start to position ourselves in a place to hear those voices, to honor those perspectives, and then starting to think about how do we shift resources? How do we change traditional ways, not unlike the caller just mentioned, of doing business to better serve those families? And we made some strides in that area. And that's something that I hope, even as I exit, the district will continue to put those practices under a microscope to better serve those families that come to us every day from immense poverty that simply struggle.
So we're hearing a lot about the McKinney-Vento Act. We have an email from Kim in the Shawnee Mission School District who says that in that district, they're proactive about letting families know what their rights are in regard to homelessness, and she puts homelessness in quotes. She says, I feel that many of these moves from school to school can be prevented due to this act. And again, I may be completely wrong. We have Derek in Kansas City who also wants to talk to us about the McKinney-Vento Act. Derek, first of all, can you explain what that act is?
The best I know for it is that it's an act to basically help students who are homeless stay in their school district of origin. And they provide transportation services to and from wherever they're staying, whether that's a homeless shelter, a foster home, a park bench, whatever it may be. So that's my understanding of it. And the reason why I called in is because I hadn't heard any mention of it up to this point. And honestly, I hardly heard anything about it when we needed to take advantage of that services. We were a foster family, so we received kids from all over Kansas City, and it definitely helped us. So I don't know if that's necessarily a one-stop solution. I definitely know it's not a one-stop solution because it is such a dynamic problem.
How did it help you? Can you explain?
Well, so we lived in Blue Springs, and we would receive children from like Raytown, Independent School District, heck, even kids within the Blue Springs School District. But we were in like one middle school area, and the student was attending school at a different middle school in Blue Springs. And so the school district wanted to change, like they actually tried to make us change where the student went. And so we were able to, with the help of our licensing agent or whatever, our caseworker, she pulled out that McKinney-Vento Act and basically told the school what's up.
Well, thanks for telling us your story, Derek. Dennis Carpenter, how useful is that in your district, in your former district, I should say?
No, well, it's my current district. For a little while. We do utilize the McKinney-Vento Act, and in a nutshell, it's policy around homeless students and those things that a district shall do. And I will tell you that not unlike many things that we get from the federal or the state government, it's an unfunded mandate. So that mandate is there to provide transportation and to do those things, and we do it to a significant extent. I would tell you, I wish I could give you the number, but I would tell you that it's an alarming percent of monies that we provide for taxis, for bus passes, and for school buses to deal with students who are homeless.
When KCUR's Central Standard returns, solutions for Hickman Mills and beyond. What are districts doing to help kids find stability at home and at school? I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay tuned. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we're trying to understand how schools and school districts might help students navigate housing issues or in some way keep them in their classrooms throughout the year, despite instability at home. Our guests are reporter Barb Shelley, outgoing Hickman Mills Superintendent Dennis Carpenter, and now researcher Russ Rumberger with us from UC Santa Barbara. He's been gathering data on school mobility. And Russ, you've been looking at this for 20 years. You must have ideas about solutions, what works and what doesn't.
Some. You could look at schools that have addressed this issue and what they've tried to do to mitigate some of the harmful effects. I've studied it as part of a larger study of both the causes, incidents, and solutions. So, but yeah, there are places that many places have to deal with this issue and have tried to do different things to help kids.
You know, we've been talking about the demographics of Hickman Mills, but it's my understanding that this is a problem that goes beyond, like, certain kinds of school districts. It seems like it's a problem just across the board. Is that right?
Yeah, mobility is a fact of life in schools. So, yes, it occurs in virtually all demographic groups, socioeconomic groups, and the like. The reasons may differ across groups, but overall, our incidence is very high. And it's directly tied to the incidence of residential mobility. You know, families move a lot, and they moved a lot during the recession that we had, but they move a lot anyway. And so it's not just tied to socioeconomic conditions, because people, middle-class families, might get a job transfer or even a promotion somewhere and then move for that reason. So anyway, there's lots of reasons that people move, and therefore there's just a lot of movement. And we actually encourage it through policy, like No Child Left Behind, where we actually promote kids to try to go to better schools. So there's lots of things that kind of contribute to this high incidence. But overall, yes, it's a very high incidence nationally.
I'm seeing different facial responses in this room to what you're saying, and I'm curious what it is that Dennis Carpenter wants to say here.
I so appreciate the comments that have been shared, and the only thing that I would offer is just some reading I've been doing of late. And it simply talks about when you look at the reason that a child moves, the impact on that child differs greatly. Put another way, when a military family who's providing for its child in a multitude of ways moves to a different military base, the impact, the trauma around that move and those things are almost non-existent in comparison to a family who's moving because of economic,
eviction.
Moving in the middle of the night to avoid an eviction or because of an eviction. So that trauma is so, so different. And the impact of that move is so different.
Okay.
I agree.
Yeah, that it sounds like we are talking about different things depending on why students are moving. I'm curious from your perspective, Russ, about solutions. I mean, some of the kinds of things that we've heard about in the reporting series that Barb Shelley worked on, things like a district actively taking steps, like a group in a district, to drive out slumlords, or another district trying to anticipate that this is going to be an issue and create new student orientation infrastructure for whenever a new student happens to arise. What are some other things? And when we think solutions, I mean, I'm not talking solve the whole problem, but just make a difference.
Yeah, well, there's solutions that kind of the front end and the back end, as you described. So one of them is to try to reduce unnecessary mobility, and another is to try to mitigate the effects of it if mobility is going to occur anyway. So those are two different strategies. So in the first side, for example, are school policies that might actually contribute to it. And one of the big ones that some districts are dealing with nationally are school closures. So when districts decide they want to start closing schools, then those families and kids are going to get moved. And that's something that schools do. And as you probably know, if you read about it, you'll find that a lot of parents actively try to fight some of those school closings, and some of them actually get reversed. But so that's a case where you're trying to prevent some mobility that is potentially preventable through some kind of school or district policy.
So trying to prevent school closures?
Well, or yes. I mean, thinking about, for example, the argument for school closures is frequently economic. You know, we're going to save money. But By consolidating. Mm-hmm. And that might be a questionable assumption, right? So maybe it's not so cost effective to actually close schools. And maybe the disruptive consequences of closing schools are such that it outweighs some of those potential economic benefits. I'm not saying that there's no reasons to close schools, but it's just one example of something a district does do or could do
But why would that have that effect? I guess I'm thinking that when you consolidate, one school would theoretically serve a greater number of students, making moves less likely to take a student out of one school and put them in another. Or is that faulty thinking on my part?
Well, it's just whatever school is going to be closed, those kids are going to change schools, right? If everything else stays the same, if there's more capacity at one school and less at another, or they close one off. So yeah, somebody's got to move as a consequence of a school closing.
Can you give us an example? So you're talking about school closures and trying to prevent those as being like a front-end solution to the school mobility problem, as in trying to prevent kids from having to switch schools in the first place. Can you give us an example of one of the back-end solutions helping students deal and succeed if they are going to be moving a lot?
Yeah, so schools could try to do something to kind of welcome and integrate new students into the school. So I've seen examples of schools that will have like a buddy program.
Can I just say, I want to help our listeners understand what they're hearing. Our guest is with us by Skype, and we're hearing his computer. So,
I don't know. I'm not using it, so I don't know.
Then perhaps, I'm not sure. There's a noise, and we hear it too, listeners. Okay, go on, Russ.
Sorry, because I don't hear it at my end, and I'm
no problem.
Just computer, so.
But please go on.
So schools can do things to try to help kids better integrate into a new school environment. And one of the things that some schools have done is have a buddy system, you know, where a new student will show up and they'll be assigned a buddy that will kind of show them around the school, teach them how things work, you know, help them kind of integrate into the school better. So that's one example. And, you know, another example is to somehow try to get school records transferred in a timely way so that students will be placed in the correct classes. This will be particularly true with special ed kids who have an IEP, an individual education plan, that are entitled to certain services. But without that record, the new school can't really place the student correctly in the right resources, hook them up with the right resources. So some things like that they can do.
How do kids and their parents in these situations get put in touch with these resources or opportunities? Does that require their own proactive pursuit, or do schools and districts help them, you know, without their seeking it out?
Well, ideally the schools will do it without the parents seeking out, because they wouldn't necessarily know those services exist, right? So a proactive school is going to have some kind of system or services set up for these new incoming kids and make those resources known and available to them and their families. But not knowing that, I'm not sure a parent could walk into a school and say, hey, can you assign a buddy to my kid? You know, if the school hasn't set up a system whereby they might recruit upperclassmen to be these mentors or be these welcoming guides, whatever they're called, then it wouldn't happen.
Right.
So I think the onus is on the school.
Yeah.
To try to set up systems to welcome and integrate students, especially during the middle of the school year. That's where it's, you know, particularly hard once the school year has already started.
Let's turn to Dennis Carpenter again. Dennis, what are the challenges to schools in doing some of these things?
I think it's incumbent upon schools to try and do those things that they believe are appropriate and that will work to mitigate the challenge associated with moves. The issue is when the numbers are so great. So if we created this buddy system at an Ingalls Elementary School that's 70% mobile from the start of the school year, we'd be walking around and doing buddy all day, and we'd be tagged for not being effective as it relates to state assessments.
So like teaching math would suffer maybe if you're having to focus on orienting a new student all the time.
Yes, with 10% mobility or less, that becomes a non-issue. When you start getting north of 50% mobility, that becomes a challenge.
Barb Shelley, you've been in Ingalls Elementary as an observer for a year now. What questions do you still have?
Well, I guess, you know, my questions do concern solutions. And really how to get people to care about this and to care about a community like Hickman Mills. We didn't get to talk about this, but I really think most of the civic energy is directed more toward the core of Kansas City. And there's this forgotten community where people are moving out. And it's really a struggle for the education system.
Well, Barb Shelley, this has been great reporting, really provocative. Thank you so much for bringing it to our attention.
I appreciate KCUR for letting me do it.
Dennis Carpenter, outgoing superintendent of Hickman Mills, thank you so much.
You're so welcome. Thank you all for your work.
And we also heard from Russ Rumberger, professor of education in the Gevertz Graduate School of Education at UC Santa Barbara. Barb's series on school mobility, which she worked on with KCUR's Ellie Moxley, is available online at kcur.org, and you can listen to this discussion and any others we've had on Central Standard at kcur.org/Central Standard. Keep talking to us. We're on Twitter, at KCURCST. This show is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, Andrea Tudhope, and Suzanne Hogan, and thanks to everyone in the newsroom for this great collaboration behind this morning's show. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to date's next.